There really isn't a world food problem. There is already enough food. We only need to solve the transportation problem of distributing that food to places that need it. Or else, the world's food problem is already being solved by the Green Revolution, with its new high-yield varieties of rice and other crops, or else it will be solved by genetically modified crops. This argument notes two things, that first-world citizens enjoy, on the average, greater per capita food consumption than do third-world citizens, and that some first-world countries, such as the United States, do or can produce more food than their citizens consume. If food consumption could be equalized over the world, or if surplus first-world food could be exported to the third world, might that alleviate third-world starvation? The obvious flaw in the first half of this argument is that first-world citizens show no interest in eating less, in order that third-world citizens could eat more. The flaw in the second half of the argument is that, while first-world countries are willing, occasionally, to export food to mitigate starvation occasioned by some crisis, first-world citizens have shown no interest in paying to feed billions of third-world citizens on a chronic basis. If that did happen, but without effective overseas family planning programs, which the U.S. government currently opposes on principle, the result would just be an increase in population proportional to an increase in available food. Therefore, genetically modified food varieties by themselves are equally unlikely to solve the world's food problems. In addition, virtually all GM crop production at present is of just four crops: soybeans, corn, canola, and cotton, not eaten directly by humans but used for animal fodder, oil, or clothing, and grown in six temperate zone countries or regions. Reasons are the strong consumer resistance to eating GM foods and the cruel fact that companies developing GM crops can make money by selling their products to rich farmers in mostly affluent temperate zone countries, but not by selling to poor farmers in developing tropical countries. Hence, the companies have no interest in investing heavily to develop genetically modified cassava, millet, or sorghum for third world farmers. As measured by common sense indicators such as human lifespan, health, and wealth, conditions have actually been getting better for many decades. Or, just look around you. The grass is still green, there's plenty of food in the supermarkets, clean water still flows from the taps, and there's absolutely no sign of imminent collapse. For affluent first-world citizens, conditions have indeed been getting better, and public health measures have, on the average, lengthened lifespans in the third world as well. But lifespan alone is not a sufficient indicator. Billions of third-world citizens, constituting about 80% of the world's population, still live in poverty, near or below the starvation level. Even in the United States, an increasing fraction of the population is at the poverty level and lacks affordable medical care, and all proposals to change this situation have been politically unacceptable. In addition, all of us know that we don't measure our economic well-being just by the present size of our bank accounts. We also look at our direction of cash flow. When you see a positive $5,000 balance, you don't smile if you then realize that you have been experiencing a net cash drain of $200 per month for the last several years, and at that rate, you have just 2 years and 1 month left before you have to file for bankruptcy. The same principle holds for our national economy and for environmental and population trends. The prosperity that the first world enjoys at present is based on spending down its environmental capital. It makes no sense to be content with our present comfort when it is clear that we are currently on a non-sustainable course. In fact, one of the main lessons to be learned from the collapses of the Maya, Anasazi, and other past societies is that a society's steep decline may begin only a decade or two after the society reaches its peak numbers, wealth, and power. The reason is simple. Maximum population, wealth, resource consumption, and waste production mean maximum environmental impact, approaching the limit where impact outstrips resources. The population crisis is already solving itself because the rate of increase of the world's population is decreasing such that the world population will level off at less than double its present level. While the prediction that the world population will level off at less than double its present level may or may not prove true, it is at present a realistic possibility. However, we can take no comfort in this for two reasons. By many criteria, even the world's present population is living at a non-sustainable level. And, as explained earlier, the larger danger that we face is not just of a twofold increase in population, but of a much larger increase in human impact if the third world succeeds in attaining a first world living standard. It is surprising to hear some first world citizens nonchalantly mentioning the world's adding only 2.5 billion more people, the lowest estimate that anyone would forecast, as if that were acceptable, when the world already holds that many people who are malnourished and living on less than $3 per day.